You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
What is it you want, Barry? What do you want? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
You want answers!
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
I see dead people.
All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it! My life has value!
Filmmaking Conversations with Damian Swaby is part of the critical conversations currently taking place across the film community. The podcast reaches out to the next generation of filmmakers who continue to look for inspiration and guidance. Remember to hit the subscribe button and leave a comment in the comments section. Share the podcast with friends and family, and have a great day. And now, over to the host of the show, Damian Swaby.
Today on Filmmaking Conversations, I'll be speaking to senior video journalist at the New York Times, Lucy King, a film and video producer with a focus on documentary and current affairs, but with experience in commercial and narrative films also. Lucy first came to my attention when I watched Inside a COVID ICU through a nurse's eyes. The short film allows you to experience the brutality of the pandemic from the perspective of nurses inside a COVID-19 intensive care unit. Two ICU nurses wore cameras to show what it's like to care for the sickest COVID patients a year into the pandemic. And now, my conversation with Lucy King. So you've worked for BBC, Vice, Discovery Channel, ITV, and the New York Times. You've done a lot of great stuff, and you've done so much in such a short while, in my opinion. So tell us exactly, how did you get into the industry?
I studied neuroscience at university because I worked in a behavioral needs school when I was at university. And I started to get really interested in the brain and behavior, human behavior, and the way people interact with each other. And I thought I wanted to perhaps be a doctor or work in mental health or somewhere around that sort of, you know, science-y kind of world. But then I which was odd, really, because I only ever liked English and art at school. I sort of started to get really into it around university. And then I realized when I was at university studying neuroscience that I actually wasn't that into the academic side of medicine, and the prospect of doing a doctor's degree for another 3, 4, 5 years didn't appeal to me. So I started to get interested in documentaries, because for me that was a sort of similar interest, like getting into human behavior and observing the way people interact with each other. You know, that sort of seemed like the same job in a way. So I began, when I left university, I applied for production companies that specialized in science, just because I had a science background. And that actually, even though it was a sort of me just falling into it, was actually a really good way of getting into the industry, because they liked taking on people with specialisms rather than people who studied media or anything more general. So I got a job as a receptionist at a production company that specialized in science and history films. And when you're sitting on reception, you start meeting all the producers and the directors who are coming through. And one of them just gave me my first job as a fact checker on a series for the BBC. And that was it, really. It just sort of went from there. Because once you're in, I mean, it's contract work, so you never feel like you're completely in. You always feel like you're about to be unemployed at the end of your current contract. But ever since then, I mean, I'm still in touch with the people I met on that first job, because it's such a small world. So it just went from there, really.
Excellent. So why exactly did you not go through with art when you were studying? Why did you decide to do more science things?
because I did the because I had this part-time job in the Pay-for Need School, which I just got because I needed to earn some money when I was studying, and it happened to be the best job I could get in my area. And it completely changed my perspective on what I wanted to spend my life doing, because I suddenly became really interested in the brain and human behavior and what goes wrong and what goes right with people. But that weirdly sort of led me to documentaries, which is its own, which sort of led me back to art. So it all kind of felt like it was falling into place eventually.
And what is it about people that interests you and human behavior? Is there anything that you've witnessed in your life, or is it just something that's just a part of you and always has been?
Yeah, I think it's the most interesting part of life. I just, it's the thing that gets me passionate. It's the thing that, I constantly cannot get bored of. It's like there's so many different variations of humans and interactions and the way they talk to each other and what they're doing in different countries and different lives. And that's what I love about documentary. It's like in the last however many years, I've had the opportunity to live different people's lives for a period of time. And that's endlessly fascinating because it's constantly changing. You know, you never one particular job. I've lived with a circus and
what was that like?
Felt what it was like to travel with a circus and been a dolphin trainer and worked alongside doctors. You understand a little bit of their perspective on the world. The circus, yeah, weird, fun, sometimes boring. We would do two shows a day for 6 days of the week, traveling around Cornwall in the UK. And it was just me. It was an observational documentary for ITV, and it was just me and a camera, and I didn't particularly know how to use a camera, so I was learning as I was going. And they gave me a camera and a caravan, and basically said, go and spend the season with them and see what we get. So I would sort of film the before, during, and after of the show and got to know the family. And there was Big Kenny, who ran the circus, and then his three kids. So Little Kenny, who was the stunt guy, and his wife, Teddy, who was the tightrope walker. And then the ringmaster, Lee, and then the clown was the youngest brother, Patrick. So the whole family were involved in the circus. So it was very, very tight network, and they all had caravans next to each other, and then my caravan, and then the people they hired. So it was kind of living a really small, intense world for a few months, but it was so fun. I mean, it's an amazing experience.
That sounds like an amazing experience indeed. Living with a family, it could be a problem itself, you know, kind of family dynamics and politics or whatever, but living with a family in the circus, that's just amazing. Did you ever feel like taking part in the circus a bit? Did they ever kind of drag you in to walk the tightrope?
I did, yeah. I did. I was a clown in the last show of the season. They said I should try and be a clown, so I dressed up, and they gave me some very basic training and a routine, and I went out and I did my very best, and I came off and I asked Big Kenny how I did, and he basically said I did terribly, and he would never employ me as a clown. apparently I haven't got very good clown timing, so I was a little bit downhearted by that, but at least I gave it a go. I also rode the Wheel of Death, which is a terrible idea. It's like a really big hamster wheel that's 30 meters high, so it's as tall as the Big Top, and it goes it rotates round, and you have to keep walking in order to keep it moving, and there's someone on the opposite end of the circle to you, and you have to go at the same time as each other, and there's no sides, so it's a very thin platform that you have to keep walking on, and if you were to fall at the top of a 30 meter tower, you would die, and die, hence being called the Wheel of Death.
And you gave it a go.
Yeah, it was a terrible idea. But I just felt like I would never get the opportunity to ride the Wheel of Death again. So so I did it and survived. But I've never been so terrified in all my life. It was awful.
I can imagine. I would be very, very terrified. I'm terrified just thinking about it, let alone seeing it, contemplating doing it. I couldn't do that. And you've done other documentaries as well, and you're quite popular across the major networks from what I can see, which is great for you. So what has brought you to the New York Times to continue with your career?
Yeah, it was a bit of a weird move for me, really, working for the New York Times, because they only do, because they are not a broadcaster like I normally work for. So I wanted to lean more towards journalism and away from TV series, because a lot of factual TV can be a little bit more entertainment-y than journalist-y, and I wanted to be more journalist-y. So someone I know from a previous job recommended me at the New York Times, and so I thought I'd give it a go, and I'm really enjoying it. What I like about it is that the New York Times, particularly in America, has such an influence. So when we talk about something, people listen, and that's an amazing platform to be able to try and influence issues, particularly because I work in the opinion section, so we can push issues. You know, if we think there's a policy or there's something that we should be getting behind, we can get behind it and tell people to follow it and do it, and, you know, issue calls to actions to America, which feels like a real opportunity, especially at the moment, because there's so much to change, so much to improve. So.
Completely. And, I love what I've seen from you and from so many other documentary filmmakers and video journalists on the New York Times. And one of your projects that stood out was about COVID and how nurses cope in hospitals regarding what's happening around COVID in New York. Are you able to tell us a bit about that documentary?
Yeah, sure. So we, at the beginning of this year, we were approaching the year anniversary of COVID, and we were interested. I'm trying to remember how this began. We were interested in. That was it. At the time there was a lot of coverage about COVID, but there was not a lot of visuals on what COVID actually was or did to a person, or what was happening in these ICU wards. You know, you'd see the data, you'd see the rates were really high, you'd hear that people were dying, but you wouldn't really understand those statistics. And so I was interested. I was really devastated at the thought of these people not having their loved ones at their side when they were dying. I felt like that was, you know, you hear a lot about in news stories about people dying, but that is just particularly tragic, the idea that they would have to die alone. And I launched on a big effort to try and get access to hospitals, particularly the ICU unit, which is a really hard thing to try and do, because these ICU units were essentially like vacuum chambers. They're just like completely hermetically sealed rooms, you know, for good reason, that only nurses could go in with lots of equipment. And, you know, they just don't let people in, because obviously they're not letting family members in. So to let the media in would be a significant thing. And so we went into the project not really expecting to get anywhere with it, but I contacted a lot of hospitals and got a lot of no's, and then we came across a really brave hospital in Arizona who were really struggling with the sheer numbers of COVID patients and really interested in doing something about it in terms of a public campaign to show people the impact of, you know, wearing a mask and staying indoors, you know, all of the sort of basic public messaging that they were trying to put out, they felt that the locals weren't listening to, and the doctors and the nurses were really incredibly tired and fatigued a year on. And so they felt like this was the right move to be able to try and have this platform on the New York Times to educate the public, to try and influence the numbers and bring the COVID rates down. So we filmed there for about a week, just observationally, not really knowing exactly what story we wanted to tell, but just observing what was happening. And it was really tragic and sad to see, and, you know, really brought it home. And, you know, the my colleague who was filming there would cry, you know. Yeah. It was a very personal journey for him too. So you know, it's not often you see a lot of death up close, and he was witnessing it, and it was hard to handle. And the story just sort of naturally became about the nurses, because that was what we were observing as being particularly phenomenal about what was going on inside those ICU wards, the fact that they were seeing this day in and day out, and they had done for a year. So it wasn't originally intended to be a piece focused around nurses, but that's what it became. Both as a sort of tribute to what they were doing for the patients and having to hold their hand in the place of the loved ones who couldn't be at their side, but also the compound trauma that they must have been experiencing for witnessing death after death after death for such a long period of time. And the response has been amazing, particularly from the nursing community. We've had some really amazing messages sent to us about how grateful they are that we've captured that experience. And it's now being used as a nursing training aid. Oh. in universities, which is not, amazing. You know, not all of them, obviously, but some, including Harvard. So we're really, really, really happy that we've been able to made a bit of an impact and sort of a bit of a tribute to nurses.
Certainly, certainly made an impact, and, you know, it really affected me. It's such a great documentary. And I must ask you, were you in the hospitals at any time for the shooting of it?
No, I work with a shooter, a cameraman who is sort of producer shooter, who went to the hospital, and I was working in conjunction with him. That sort of works quite well for us at the moment.
Okay.
Particularly in those environments, because you only really can take one person in there. If you take more than one, it doesn't really work, because you need such a light footprint. So I tend to do more of the reporting, the office-based reporting, and he's the one who gets it, gets in there for these particular shoots. For other non-New York Times stuff, I'm always on the shoots, but this particular setup, I'm in the office.
Really good work from him, because he captured a lot. And as you said, there was one particular scene, if I can use that word, in the documentary, where the nurse was holding hands with a woman who was dying. And I think the family were watching through a laptop. Maybe it was via Zoom or something like that. And I watched it and I thought, filming that must be devastating. Like, you're watching that happen in that process. And I wondered who else was there and how the family and the nurses reacted to having a crew there. But as you just said, it was one cameraman. It's quite emotional, and it must be to a certain degree draining for him to have seen that and staying professional and capturing what needed to be captured. Whereas when he was interviewing, I'm not sure if he actually did the interviews, when he was in one of the nurses' homes, and she, well, a few of their homes, and she spoke about the pressure of being a nurse and not telling anybody because she wanted to stay strong for her children. She wanted to be the strong mum. Mm. That situation, was that just one camera guy as well? Or did he ask the questions as well?
Yeah. Just one. Just one-on-one for that. Yeah. No, there's a great deal of intimacy in those moments. And I mean, I think for the nurses, there's a certain amount of, I think they liked being able to show people the intensity of their environment, their daily environment. There's a certain amount of relief to be able to show people what it's like. The family, we were a little bit worried. Well, we were very worried about, actually. It's an incredibly intimate moment, and they could have had any kind of reaction to the fact that we had captured that. So we went over to the house and met the family and had a cup of tea with them and explained what we were trying to do. I certainly don't get involved in projects and have that degree of, I don't mess with people's lives unless I feel like there's a reason to do it. And in that case, I feel like there was a real public interest in showing that moment. And so we explained what our intentions were. And luckily the family were very much in support. They saw it as giving her death a significance that wouldn't have been there otherwise. You know, they were happy that she could be part of something that might help reduce further deaths. So that was great. And we're still in contact with the hospital and the family sporadically, and they were really happy with what we did and the way we treated it. So that was a huge, huge relief.
How do you feel personally when people ignore COVID, when they say it doesn't exist? Because one of the nurses said that when people come into the hospital that may not believe COVID exists, they never say that. They just want help. They want to not feel sick anymore. So how do you personally feel about people who don't believe COVID exists?
Have you thought of upgrading your cinematography game? Would you like to have an ASC cinematographer mentor you for free? Join veteran cinematographer Suki Medenzovic, ASC, Disney, Pixar, FX Networks, Netflix, American Horror Story, as he teaches you how to create beautiful images using three lighting techniques he has mastered on film sets over his 30-plus years in the film industry. Each technique uses basic, low-cost lighting equipment so that anyone can achieve beautiful visuals no matter your project's budget. If you want to take your cinematography to the next level, visit filmmakingconversations.com to sign up for instant access.
Yeah, it's weird. The film is now on YouTube and there are thousands of comments, and most of them are really positive. But a few of them are COVID deniers. It's a weird one because I think that a film like that is hard to disagree with. I'm not sure what they're seeing that doesn't feel real or feels like a conspiracy. I don't actually think a lot, to be honest, in that I don't feel like there's a lot of reason behind what they think. I'm not sure if they've put a lot of thought into, you know, thinking that COVID actually doesn't exist. And I think that there is fortunately such a small portion of the population that perhaps we don't need to take their opinions too seriously, because it's not true. And actually a few of the messages that we were sent was from people who'd said that their relatives had been convinced through watching the video, which was interesting, because I think in their case, it was the first time they'd actually seen it, you know, rather than heard about it, they'd actually seen the reality of it. And that felt good. That, you know, even if we can sort of get one person to the vaccination center, then it's worthwhile.
Good. I agree. I completely agree with you. Sorry to hear about the comments that have been on the video. I mean, I can imagine some of them, but there's always one or two, I think, when you put stuff up on YouTube, regardless if it's a serious documentary or video journalism or a narrative piece, there's always going to be some nasty people. But you yourself, I've seen some of your work as a documentary filmmaker and a video journalist producing great stuff. And I was really shocked in a great way to see James Gallagher X Love, a narrative piece directed by Gallagher. Really, really good. So tell us about that film and how you got involved with it.
So I'd been working in documentary in London for a few years, decided to move to New York because I thought I'd regret it if I didn't.
Why did you think that?
No, I just felt like if I just lived in London for my entire job, especially pre-kids, that I might regret it. And I just had this sort of pipe dream of living in New York. And I thought it would be easy to get a job in New York because there's a good industry there. But it's actually not easy to get a job in a different city because you don't know anyone. And this whole industry is about who you've worked with before, because there's no jobs boards for this industry. You just work with people you've worked with before. So it was actually hard when I arrived in New York. And I ended up getting a job not really in documentaries, at a production company in Brooklyn that made arts and commercial films, and through someone I'd worked with before. And it ended up actually being a great move for me because I would never in London have taken a job working on commercials or music videos or arts films or short films, because I was so wrapped into documentaries and I love documentaries, but I was sort of forced into these new genres just because that was the job that I happened to sort of be able to get when I was in New York. And I absolutely loved it. It massively expanded my sort of skill repertoire. So suddenly I was line producing and I was working with budgets and crews and art departments and scripts and all these things that I had never worked with before. And what was great about this particular production company, which was run by a DP called a director of photography called Kevin Hayden, he really believed in taking the money from commercial projects. So, we might do a commercial for Converse, for example, and then we would take the profit from that job and we would invest it in a short film that we believed in. So we'd cut all the rates for the crew and we would put more time in than we were billing them, or, we'd just sort of make it work and we'd put lots of time and effort into these short film projects. And so James Gallagher, I can't remember how we met him, but he came to us with his script. It's very much a passion project of his. And so we jumped on it. We filmed in the north of Manhattan at this old school. Susan Sarandon was there. She was actually a family friend of James Gallagher's. And it was great. I mean, it was a really beautiful, beautiful piece that came together really well. We were really pleased with it.
So you should be. I mean, straight away, the cinematography is, amazing, as well as the performance and the story as a whole. So you've learned those new skills from that company. Can you see yourself doing another narrative piece again?
It's not where my passion lies, but I think that what interests me in the future is these sort of what they call the cross-genre films. So American Animals would be a great example of a documentary that's actually filmed like a film. So it's I don't know if you've seen it, but it interviews the people who were at the incident you're talking about, in a traditional documentary way, but then it turns them into fiction. It turns what they're talking about into a fiction film. So you're watching what becomes a hybrid, where it looks and sounds like a movie, but actually it's a documentary, and they come in and out of those scenes and say, actually, no, it wasn't like that. It was like this. And then the scene changes. And I think that's great. And so my knowledge of narratives and scripts, I think, will come into documentary, because the lines are blurring more and more.
I can understand that. Is that something to do with politics, American Animal? Because I've seen...
it's about a heist. It's about a bunch of students who steal a painting from their college library. And you should watch it from there. It's great. It's a really great film. It's actually one of my favorite documentaries.
A heist. Okay, I'll definitely give it a go. The one I was thinking about, I can't remember what it's called. It's about young Republicans. I can't remember what it's called.
I don't know that one.
Yeah. But I didn't realize what it was. So it was just on. I started watching it. And I was like, is this a documentary? Is this a film? What? And I just...
It's great. And it really opens up the... the world of opportunities for documentary. Because if you can sort of... use all the tools that narrative films do, then that's great. I'd love to do more of those, and they're fairly rare at the moment, done to the level that American Animals is. So I think there's a lot more to explore.
And you mentioned earlier about when you first had a camera on the shoot for ITV and the circus, and you wasn't as skilled as you may be now. Do you think in the future you can see yourself doing documentaries as a self-shooter? Because a lot of people are doing that as self-shooters now, and potentially you going into places like hospitals or parts of Africa or wherever it may be, and producing by yourself with all your experience now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always good to know your way around a camera so that you can talk to editors and DPs about camera stuff. Personally, I think I work best with a creative cameraman or a DP. So in the ideal world, I would work alongside someone who's holding the camera, because I think that's sort of a good creative balance. But I think if you don't know how to hold a camera, then you limit yourself a lot, because there are certain situations and budgets that mean that you can't afford to have a camera and another person beside you. So I think getting yourself to a certain standard in terms of being able to shoot yourself is a really useful skill to have, especially with editing, and also with editing as well. Being able to edit and you being able to be a one-man band if you need to be is always going to be useful.
Certainly is. And is there anything you're working on now that we'll be able to watch very soon?
I'm actually doing a follow-up to that Nurses film.
Great.
To do with the areas of America that are very unvaccinated. And now that 97% of hospitalized COVID patients are unvaccinated, we're trying to get back into the hospitals to sort of visualize that statistic to try and encourage people to get the vaccine. So I'm doing that at the moment. And then there's a few different projects, actually. There's the sort of four or five I'm working on.
Four or five? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, there's always things bubbling away. And, a lot of the time these development projects take a while to filter through, so you've got to keep things burning.
Yeah. And the follow-up doc, when do you think that will be released? Have you got no kind of date for us, or are you just seeing how it pans out for now?
Maybe in a month, something like that.
Okay, great.
Quite soon.
And you'll be back in Arizona or very different hospitals?
I think we're gonna head to a different the statistics have changed, so I think we would head to a different state where it's where the lowest numbers of people are getting vaccinated and has the highest rates of COVID, which looks at the moment like Arkansas or Missouri or Louisiana, somewhere like that.
My friend's from Arkansas. He's a bit suspect in terms of COVID. He's a bit. I should ask him if he's got his double jab yet. I should ask him.
He's probably one of the many who haven't got the vaccine yet.
Yes, I'm sure of that. But Lucy, thanks so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to speak to me. It's been great learning about what you've been doing in your career and being able to discuss the brilliant documentary that you're a part of. And I really appreciate that.
If you like this podcast, share it with friends. Leave a comment in the comment section and hit the subscribe button.